Bonjour, and welcome to Bon Appetit on Demand on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today, I'll begin reading from the September 2025 issue, which focuses on food and fitness. First up is a letter from the editor, Jamila Robinson. I confess, I was distracted during a match I was watching at the U.S. Open last year. I had been served a chocolate bar filled with nafeh and pistachio cream by Fix Dessert Chocolatier, the dessert company credited with originating the viral Dubai chocolate. I became obsessed with the silken and crispy interior, trying to understand how they managed to get the cream to ooze so gently under the dark chocolate exterior. Cheers, applause. I'd missed a break point or some shot, but it was worth it. That Fix bar was just one of the fabulous things I'd eaten during the tournament. There was a refreshing ceviche, a buttery lobster roll on the concourse, crunchy tater tots shaped like donuts, and between the day and night sessions, Escovitch shrimp at a pop-up Tatiana by Kwame Onwuachu inside Aces, just one of the New York restaurants associated with the Grand Slam event. Food is so integral to how we watch and experience sports. Hospitality investors positioned their new restaurants and bars along Formula One race routes, echoing the ultra-lux dining in Las Vegas and Monte Carlo. Sports venues are where many visitors experience a city's culinary scene. At BMO Stadium, home of the Los Angeles Football Club, and its adjacent food hall, you'll find Korean noodles and Thai chicken sandwiches, a gateway to the goodies familiar to soccer fans that can be found at regional grocery stores, eateries, and markets. In this month's issue, we head to bars, where everyone watches women's sports, and visit ballparks for concessions that represent their cities. Crab fries at Baltimore's Camden Yards, anyone? These snacks and novelties are part of what we find entertaining about sports. To balance out all the city snacks, our senior service editor, Kelsey Jane Youngman, and Test Kitchen editors collaborated with nutritionists to develop 6 new recipes to enrich your health and well-being and to keep you moving in your neighborhood park or places like Atlanta's Beltline, a system of pathways where residents walk, run, skate, and ride bikes around the city. Senior writer Pervez Shalwani reports on this area that connects to Mercedes-Benz Stadium, home to the Atlanta Falcons and some of the city's best bites. Antico Pizza Napolitana, the West Side classic, known for its celebrity after parties and long lines, is located in the Battery, Atlanta, just outside of Atlanta's tourist park. The Pomodorini Pizza is loaded with blistered cherry tomatoes and worth missing a field goal or two. Step Up to the Plate, by associate editor in cooking Nina Moskowitz, highlights 4 fan favorites. The crack of a wood bat, the roar of a sold-out crowd, the snap of a juicy hot dog. To us, a baseball game is as much about the snacks as it is about a home team win. Each city has its own signature offerings, nodding to local cuisine or even celebrating an MVP. Here are 4 iconic ballpark bites we'd happily wait in line for. Takoyaki, Dodger Stadium, Los Angeles. I am a lifelong Dodgers fan, and last season I found a new favorite food order, piping hot takoyaki from renowned Japanese chain Tsukiji Gindako. Crispy, custardy fried octopus balls are doused in tangy sweet sauce, a drizzle of kewpie mayo, and finished with a dusting of seaweed and dancing bonito flakes. This also happens to be star player Shohei Ohtani's alleged favorite snack. Kelsey Jane Youngman, Senior Service Editor. Sonoran Dog, Chase Field, Phoenix. The Sonoran hot dog is one of the comfort eats of southern Arizona. An unsung regional specialty, this dog reflects the borderlands and a daily life on both sides of the line. Bacon wrapped, heaped with pinto beans and pico de gallo, and placed in a toasted New England roll, Chase Field's footlong version is about as good as ballpark food gets, ideal with a cold brew. Chris Malloy, contributing writer. The local Fry's, Camden Yards, Baltimore. Loaded Fry's are a ballpark staple, but only at Oriole Park at Camden Yards can you order a basket of crispy spuds smothered with crab dip, a specialty of the local Fry, paired with a plastic pint of Natty Bow and fantasies of a winning season. Few things taste as quintessentially Baltimore. Emil Stanek, contributing editor. Brisket Acho, Kauffman Stadium, Kansas City, Missouri. You haven't truly experienced the K until you've spent a sweltering evening stuffing your face with brisket helmet nachos. Stadium-issue tortilla chips get topped with four staples of Kansas City barbecue. Slow-smoked meat, baked beans, cheesy corn, and a bright but sweet slaw. Food is half the fun of going to a game, and for me, this over-the-top treat is inextricably linked to cheering on the boys in blue. Emily Ferris, senior commerce writer. Feeling thirsty now? You may want to try this recipe for a beer-garita, a supersized margarita riff, which is a one-carafe wonder. The following recipe yields 4 to 6 servings. The beer-garita perfectly encapsulates laid-back summer sipping. For starters, it all happens in one pitcher. No intense multi-step mixing here, and it combines the familiarity of a margarita with the effervescence of beer. Crisp, bright flavors of Mexican lager mellow out punchy citrus and tequila, making this drink just right for hot days. 1 1/2 cups tequila, such as Patron, 1 cup Grand Marnier or other orange liqueur, 1 cup fresh orange juice from about 4 oranges, 1/4 cup fresh lime juice from about 2 limes, 1/2 teaspoon Diamond Crystal or 1/4 teaspoon Morton kosher salt, plus more, optional, 2 12-ounce bottles or cans Mexican beer, such as Corona, lime wheels for serving. Stir tequila, Grand Marnier, orange juice, lime juice, and 1/2 teaspoon Diamond Crystal or 1/4 teaspoon Morton kosher salt in a large pitcher or punch bowl until salt is dissolved. Gradually pour in beer, then stir gently just until combined. If desired, pour some salt on a small plate. Rub outside rims of 4 to 6 rocks glasses with a citrus wheel. Roll moistened rims in salt to coat. Fill glasses with ice. Pour in beer garita. Garnish each drink with a lime wheel. Get creative. Swap in other acidic juices such as grapefruit, lemonade, or even mango nectar to remix the vibe. Get salty. Create a mixed salt station to allow guests to customize their own glasses. Think chili lime such as tajine, flaky sea salt, and even the pink stuff for whimsy. If you're looking for a way to beat the heat, this recipe for soothing soba may be just what you need. By Hannah Osbrink. One of my earliest memories is slurping Japanese zaru soba prepared by my mother. I was little and shirtless, a kitchen towel wrapped around my neck, legs dangling off the chair, with the loud hum of our window AC unit nearby. These cold buckwheat noodles were instant refreshment on the stickiest of summer days, when dinner needed to be quenching as much as filling. Now, when the humid weather rolls around, I call on this dish to replenish me from the inside out. Start with cooked, drained, and rinsed soba noodles. My mother would scrub them like laundry, ensuring every last bit of starch was washed off. This shocks the noodles to halt cooking and prevents them from clumping. Next, make a mensuyu, a savory noodle soup base. Typically, mensuyu features dashi, mirin, soy sauce, and sake. To keep it supremely simple and pantry-friendly, I skip the sake, and my family is none the wiser. Instant dashi is a convenient umami bomb powder I substitute in for the homemade stuff. Serving it with a couple of ice cubes both gently dilutes and intensely chills the mixture, like a martini on the rocks. I like to top my soba with sliced scallion, crisp nori, a squeeze of wasabi, an amount of daikon, Don't skip that last one. When grated, this bittersweet radish is like fluffy snow melting into the sauce. You could arrange the Zaru sopa in neat bowls like my mother would do, creating picture-perfect compositions. But I often devour it straight from the colander, noodles strewn about and messily dipped into the mentsuyu. Minutes later, gone. Here's how to make it. Bring 3 tablespoons mirin, 3 tablespoons soy sauce, 1 tablespoon instant dashi powder, such as bondashi, and 3 cups water to a boil in a small saucepan. Reduce heat so mixture is at a simmer and cook until flavors come together, about 4 minutes. Let mentsuyu cool, then transfer to an airtight container. Cover and chill until ready to use. Meanwhile, cook 6 ounces dried soba noodles, about 2 bundles, in a medium pot of boiling water according to package directions. About 4 minutes is typically just right. Drain in a colander, then rinse under cold running water, taking care to remove any residual starch. Let sit 5 minutes. Divide noodles between 2 bowls. Ladle mentsuyu into 2 smaller bowls and add an ice cube or 2 to each for an extra refreshing broth. Serve noodles topped with grated daikon, thinly sliced scallions, shredded toasted nori, and or wasabi, if desired. Dip a small amount of noodles in mentsuyu at a time, adding more ice cubes as you go, as needed. 2 servings. Next, from the fourth trimester column, the blueberry oatmeal that got us through grief, then birth. What does it mean to become a mother while grieving your own mom? By Halle Bay Ramdine. It's only later, when you begin to sleep again, that you truly come to understand the blur of time that takes place in the days and weeks after having a child. After my daughter was born, I stopped looking at the clock. There was no need when her cries and coos told us what she needed and when. Although she is my only child, this experience of surrendering to time in the service of caring for another was already familiar to me. Just the year before, I was caring for my late mother. After 7 challenging, magnificent years of gracefully facing a terminal cancer diagnosis, she left this life for a plane of consciousness beyond my reach. Time blurred then too, and I only remembered its relevance when an appointment needed to be attended, medication given, or when her hunger, this precious and elusive urge, would arise. In the last weeks before her appetite disappeared altogether, she ate only one meal over and over again, a bowl of steel-cut oatmeal. I made countless bowls for her and myself, and like so much of the food prepared and shared between us over my adulthood, every ingredient was elemental, imbued with intention and meaning. To make and share a bowl with her was part love spell, cast so this bond would find a way to live on, and part prayer, one of pure gratitude for the blessing it was to have this woman as my mother and truest friend. Every time I made the oatmeal, I take an inventory of each ingredient's story. Steel-cut oats, a staple from my childhood breakfast. Almond butter, its addition to oatmeal, an idea from my dear friend Alicia, and a revelation to my mom and me so many years ago. Inky, homegrown blueberries harvested by the family that would become the grandparents to my daughter, and nutmeg, always freshly grated, in honor of my father, who passed unexpectedly just the year before. This was the last food she ate, the last food I made for her, and the first thing I made for myself after my baby girl was born. It took me a long while to get back to cooking for myself. The first several weeks post-birth were spent mostly in bed, recovering from a surprise cesarean while simultaneously in a stupor of love, longing, and grief made me uninterested in leaving the cocoon of the bedroom. I felt bliss for this tender soul in my arms and a bottomless sorrow that I was experiencing this mystery of motherhood without my own mother to share it with. I wanted to tell her how much I suddenly understood. There were a million confidences, apologies, and secrets pressing at my seams, all intended for her alone. In her absence, they were offered to the endless nights with a delirious, sleep-deprived hope that they'd find her in that place beyond the here and now. Those nights gave way to serene mornings. I ate so well and so beautifully in those hours just after dawn. At some point, the warm body next to me would disappear, and plates full of scrambled eggs, thinly sliced avocado, buttered toast, and a strip of perfectly cooked bacon would appear on the table next to my bed. My love took it upon himself to feed us, me and by extension our daughter, with an intense focus and care. It only occurred to me much later that this attendance was no different than the one I'd given to my mother. To give and then receive this particular form of tenderness came to a fine point of understanding while I nursed my daughter. All of us, myself to my mother, my partner to me, and me now to my daughter, were providing nourishment, food given to sustain and promote good health and well-being. Soon, we began taking short walks, the baby bundled close to me as we shuffled to the end of the block in the early spring. One late morning, I left the baby tucked into the crook of her father's arm as they both peacefully dozed after a long night of diaper changes and yelps of hunger, and made my way to the kitchen to cook for myself. I made oatmeal the way I did a year before, with the last of those fat blueberries still tucked in the recesses of the freezer. I ate it quietly and without interruption, savoring the solitude that is nourishment as well. That's one of those things I would tell my mother. I understand what it means to have and hold yourself, even when you're in such need of the care from others. Thank you for showing me how to give and receive nourishment. Thank you for showing me how to give it to myself. The fourth trimester is a series where parents share the meals that nourish them postpartum. For more, head to boneappetit.com/fourth-trimester. Haley Bay Ramdine is Bon Appetit's content director. She explores the terrain of food, family, and well-being, and the meals and moments that shape them. Here's her recipe for blueberry muffin baked oatmeal, which yields 6 to 8 servings. This dish delivers on a cozy, comforting breakfast with its warm notes of vanilla, cinnamon, and nutmeg, an earthy almond butter base, and loads of blueberries, fresh or frozen, dealer's choice. They'll be prepared for frozen berries juices to run through the batter if you go that route. It keeps like a dream and reheats well in the microwave or oven, so go ahead and pretend that you're meal prepping. No matter how you mix this one up, it lands you in the realm of oat bar meets blueberry muffin, made for eating straight from the pan while still in your pajamas. Unsalted butter for pan, 2.5 cups old-fashioned oats, 3 tablespoons chia seeds, 1 teaspoon baking powder, 3/4 cups sliced almonds divided, 1.5 cups fresh or frozen blueberries, 1 large egg, 1/2 cup almond butter, 1/2 cup packed 100 grams dark brown sugar, 1 teaspoon diamond crystal or 1/2 teaspoon Morton kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon freshly ground nutmeg, 1/2 teaspoon almond extract, optional, 1/2 teaspoon vanilla extract, 2.5 cups milk of choice divided, plus more for serving, optional, 1/4 cup blueberry jam, pure maple syrup, for serving, optional, 1 lemon, optional. Place a rack in middle of oven, preheat to 375 degrees. Butter an 8x8-inch baking pan or dish. Toss oats, chia seeds, baking powder, and 1/2 cup almonds in a medium bowl to combine. Add blueberries. Toss to coat. Mix egg, almond butter, brown sugar, salt, cinnamon, nutmeg, almond extract if using, and vanilla extract in a large bowl. Pour in 1/2 cup milk of choice and whisk until almond butter, sugar, and salt are dissolved. Gradually pour in remaining 2 cups milk, whisking constantly to combine. Pour over oat mixture and stir to combine. Transfer oatmeal to prepared pan, making sure berries are evenly distributed. Make a few divots over surface with a large spoon and fill each one with a dollop of jam. Sprinkle remaining 1/4 cup almonds over oatmeal. Place pan on a rimmed baking sheet and bake oatmeal until slightly puffed and almonds are toasted, 30 to 40 minutes. If using frozen blueberries or a glass baking dish, oatmeal may need to bake 5 to 10 minutes longer. Let cool 5 minutes. Divide oatmeal among bowls. Drizzle with pure maple syrup and or milk of choice and grate zest from lemon over if desired. Next, cook hard, run harder. Restaurant workers are trading post-shift drinks for early morning runs, redefining restaurant culture, one sweaty mile at a time, by Sam Stone. It's 9:30 a.m. on a humid Thursday morning, and I'm already perspiring through my moisture-wicking shirt. Next to me, line cooks, sous chefs, and other assorted restaurant workers, clad in athleisure, are limbering up in the middle of a narrow street in downtown Manhattan, the skyscrapers casting us into shadow in the sunny weather. Before I've been able to fully come to terms with the fact that I'm about to run 4 sweaty miles across 2 boroughs with these people, we're off, winding our way through Chinatown, running north toward the never-ending Williamsburg Bridge, and eventually over to our destination in the neighborhood. This is Crown High Run Club, a group of runners from within the constellation of restaurants in the Kent Hospitality Group. Crown High is just one of many such clubs created by hospitality workers around the country in recent years. In Portland, Oregon, the French-inflected tasting menu restaurant Le Pigeon jogs together as Bird Dog Movement Club. The 86 Run Club in Los Angeles and Miami bills itself as a hospitality-run club and wellness meetup, and the Food Runners in Toronto have been clocking in miles for more than a decade. The unique spirit of each run club reflects their respective restaurant kitchens. The chefs at 11 Madison Park, who cook with rigorous Michelin-starred exactitude, often run Central Park's hilly 6-mile loop. We get addicted to the feeling of pushing ourselves, Chef de Cuisine Dominique Roy says, but it's competitive too. At Austin's Commodore Run Club, Chef Philip Spear emphasizes the physical and mental wellness aspects of fitness. People come to the Run Club looking to make some changes and continue to use the community to stay sober, he says. Many runs end with Conscious, baked by Spear himself, and a meeting at Ben's Friends, a sobriety support group for those interested. For Crown High, the team dynamic crystallized after Jamal James Kent's sudden passing in June 2024. He and his wife Kelly created the Run Club to give their staff a chance to get out of the kitchen and build camaraderie. Instead of post office drinks, they could spend an hour outdoors, shaking off the stress of the kitchen, getting in some miles together. After Kent passed away, the group transformed into a weekly run to grieve, to offer each other quiet support, and to keep Kent's spirit joyfully alive, 1 mile at a time. A few miles into our run, after the damp dark scaffolding tunnels, past cramped sidewalk vegetable vendors, we crested the steep Williamsburg Bridge. The incline left my legs burning and my breath ragged, and my pace slowed despite my best efforts. As if on cue, another runner slowed to jog beside me as we fell behind the group. Had teamwork become an unconscious habit after years of cooking together on the line? Drenched in sweat, the group was all smiles hitting the bridge's descent, the final leg before our finish line. Broody, Kent Hospitality's new bakery and cafe. Awaiting us were fried egg sandwiches, lacy-edged whites with a sunshine yellow yolk, creamy American cheese, and pork jowl bacon so perfectly salty smoky I could have cried cuddled up on a pillowy brioche bun. Outside, as runners munched their pastries, someone pointed out the street sign. Appropriately, we'd found ourselves on Kent Avenue. Philip Spear, chef owner, Commodore, founded Austin's Commodore Run Club and has seen it grow into something of an institution since it began 6 years ago. We've sparked a couple of run clubs around the country that have modeled what we do, he says. The club's 3 5K runs a week were primarily a way for Spear and his team to move away from after-work drinks. We figured it didn't have to be the bar, Spear says. It was less about the environment and more about the people. Now they've grown to become an essential bonding experience. The community and the camaraderie that's built with the group and running miles, there's not much like it. One thing that compares, Spear says, is working a line together. Kelly Kent, partner, Kent Hospitality Group, remembers watching her late husband train for the New York City Marathon. When she finally signed up for her first half marathon, he helped her train. He ran with me the whole time, she says. When she graduated to marathons, he cheered her on from the sidelines every year. He'd make the biggest poster possible over my head, she remembers laughing. Jamal passed on a Saturday, and when a group came together at Crown Chai the next day to grieve, many of them asked Kelly if she planned on canceling Monday's scheduled run. But nearly 100 co-workers, friends, and supporters showed up that morning. We ran, she says. This is how we coped. Jerry Francois, running coach, runs like water in a brook, smooth, bouncing up and down, and yes, babbling. As Crown High's coach, he's the unofficial mid-run hype man. It's possible there's never been someone as enthusiastic about running as Francois. On a recent run, I watched him click his heels 6 consecutive times. But Francois is more than a good vibes machine. When members have shown up without running shoes, he stepped in. Tommy wanted to get back into running, but he didn't have the best shoes, Francois recalls. At the next meetup, Francois gifted him a new pair. I just remember how much his face lit up, he says. Months later, Tommy signed up for the New York City Marathon. This is what Jamal wanted us to be a part of, Francois says. Thanks so much for listening to these on-demand readings from the September 2025 issue of Bon Appetit on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying au revoir for now.